Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
2 weeks from today, on August 21st, the sky will turn suddenly dark across a diagonal stretch of the United States from Newport, Oregon to Charleston, South Carolina. But even when the sky goes black in a way that is unlike anything else that can be experienced on Earth, it will be filled with light. Because when you consider all the photons that can't be perceived by the eye, you come to the realization that the universe is literally made of light. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Bob Berman is an astronomy writer and science editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac. He opens his book with an astonishing fact. In terms of individual items in the cosmos, 99.9999999% of those items, that should have been seven nines, are photons. And he'll tell us, humans who discovered all those invisible bands on the spectrum and discovered how to harness them changed the course of history forever. Bob Berman's new book is called Zapped, From Infrared to X-Rays, The Curious History of Invisible Light. Bob, welcome to Think.
Well, great to be here. Thanks.
I want to start with this idea that the universe is almost entirely made of light. That sounds just like a beautiful metaphor, but it's scientific fact.
Oh, it is, yeah. For every little subatomic particle, there's billions of photons of light. Yeah, it's mostly light.
And very nearly all the light that we've ever seen, including the ones that are brightening the studios that you and I are sitting in right now, all that light derives from the sun. Explain that for us.
Yes, because in addition to direct sunlight and the light that bounces off the sun, which is moonlight and starlight, even the artificial light we have is really owed to the sun. Only nuclear power. We would have had that uranium even without the sun. But even then, how would we have extracted it from its ore and all the rest? So you need power. So all the fossil fuels, even water from hydropower, that rain couldn't have gone back to higher altitudes without evaporation, and that's the sun too. So the sun really is ultimately responsible.
Most of us remember from school that light is both a particle and a wave, but what does that mean? What is light exactly?
Yeah, it's hard to wrap your head around, and certainly people have been trying for millennia to do it. And to make things worse, it acts like a wave when you do certain kinds of experiments and like a particle when you do others. And where it is depends on who's asking. If you watch it go through one slit or another, then it always will remain a wave. But if you just let it do its thing and be detected on a detector further away, then it can kind of blurrily pass through both slits in an experiment. Only a wave can do that. If you measure which slit it goes through, then it becomes a particle. If you don't care which slit it went through, then it acts like a wave. So it's strange in a lot of ways.
How does light come into existence?
One way only, and that is when an atom gets a bit of energy in any one of a number of ways. Its electron, if it's hydrogen, or electrons, if it's any atom other than hydrogen, jump up to a higher orbit where they don't like to be at all. So they fall back, usually in a fraction of a second. And when the electron falls back closer to the center of its atom, that's how light is created. It's the only way. So an electron falls back, suddenly a little bit of light, a photon of light appears like as if from magic, out of nothingness, and then immediately starts racing away at its famous speed of 186,000 miles a second.
Okay, I know that's approximately the speed of light, but your book made me realize it never occurred to me to ask how anybody figured that out in the first place. That was not an easy accomplishment.
Not at all. People even in ancient times realized it was darn fast, and many thought it was instantaneous, that it required no time at all for light to travel. Because after all, 186,282 miles a second means that it will go across a room in just a few billionths of a second. No experiment could detect that. They tried. Lots of people tried. Cranky old Galileo tried, and they did things like they'd set up a lantern with a quick release shutter, and then have a assistant on a mountaintop a mile away, and they'd tell the assistant, when you see the light from my lantern, release your shutter. And then they figured, Galileo figured he could see the delay. As soon as he released his lantern, how much time would it take him to see the return light from his assistant a mile away? And guess what? It was always pretty close to instantaneous, just pretty much as fast as it would take the guy's muscle to respond, because nobody could detect that. It was a tiny fraction of a second. So it was amazing when somebody finally did. The guy's name was Ole Rømer. He was a Norwegian. And he figured it out, not here on Earth, but by the fact that when you observe Jupiter and its moons through a telescope, any small telescope will do this, you see that as its moons are going around Jupiter, they seem to run slower for half the year and then go around faster for the other half of the year, which doesn't make sense. They go around slower during the time of the year when we're going away from Jupiter. And he figured out, well, the reason must be that since Earth is moving away from Jupiter at that time, each second, the image, it's almost like a movie, each frame of the movie has a little farther to go before it reaches us. And so it takes a little bit more time to see that frame of the movie of Jupiter's moons, and that delays them. So they get to each position in their orbit around Jupiter at a delayed period of time. And from that alone, he correctly calculated the speed of light to an accuracy of about 25%, which was pretty good for four centuries ago.
So the lay definition of light is what we can see, but human eyes are actually pretty limited in terms of the things they can perceive. Tell us, for example, what birds and insects see in the sky that we miss.
Well, they often, many of them can see into the ultraviolet that we can't. And that gives them a lot of advantages, and their vision is sharper than ours, and so perceiving different colors and the rest. But even the way we perceive things is a little weird, Chris, because we don't ever really see light itself, because light is invisible. We've now found that light is made of waves of magnetism, and at right angles to it, waves of electricity. And you can't see an electrical field, of course, and you can't see magnetism. So anything that's light, like a sunset, or anything that we see as blue or colorful or anything, in actuality has no color, has no brightness. And instead, when our retinal cells, 6 million of them, at least the cone-shaped ones that give us color vision, when they get hit by a little bit of this electricity and magnetism, they respond with a little bit of electricity of their own, sending it along these heavy-duty cables up into our brains, where tens of billions of cells are designed to respond and give us the sensation of what we'd call blue or red or a sunset or brightness. But that's not actually out there. That's our reaction to getting hit with invisible magnetic and electrical pulses. So let's be clear, everything we see around us, even though we call it the external world, is actually an internal experience that's happening in our brains, which means, and this is really far out, that when you look around the room right now, you're seeing the inside of your brain. Huh. So if you thought the inside of your brain was kind of wet and dark and squishy and you know, not a place you'd want to be, the actual, at least one section of the brain, is what you're seeing around the room. It's those colors and those shapes and the brightnesses. That's all forming in our minds. That's not in the real world. The real world of visualness, if that's a word, which it probably isn't, is blank, because real light is just magnetism and electricity, and that's blank. We can't see that stuff.
All right, I want to talk about William Herschel. He discovered a planet, which is impressive enough on its own. He also discovered something nobody would have thought to look for, and that is infrared radiation.
Exactly. And did you avoid the name of that planet that he discovered because almost nobody says Uranus correctly?
No, actually, I just thought that I'd leave that to you.
Yeah, so he was the first one to discover a planet. You know, nobody suspected there's planets out there that we can't see, planets that are too far away or too dim. It was in no holy book, no philosopher, no brilliant thinker ever said, oh, just wait, someday we'll find new planets. And so when he found Uranus, it was the most astonishing thing ever in 1781. And of course, he got praised around the world, and it was a really, really big deal. He went from this amateur, really, astronomer to one of the most famous astronomers in the world. So he didn't need any other discovery. And yet, he's the guy, some 17 years later, in the year 1800, who first found something else that no one saw coming, which was invisible light. Nobody had ever written that maybe there are kinds of light that we can't see, that are there, but we just don't perceive them. And so when he found the very first of these, which we now call infrared, and which he called calorific rays, which he discovered sort of by accident, that was a big deal too. So he did two big deals, and yet if you ask most people today to name the greatest scientist, I don't think a lot of them would say William Herschel, but he deserves it.
Calorific rays sort of implies that infrared is heat, but in fact you say it generates heat, but it's not the same thing as heat.
Yes, this really sounds like you've read the book.
I have read the book.
Yeah, because people really don't know this. You know, people have heat lamps in their bathroom, and not many people say, no, it's not really a heat lamp. It's an infrared lamp. What it does is produces the feeling of heat because, yeah, you're right, they're absolutely different. Infrared is a form of light with the waves longer or further apart than the visible light that we see. But it has just the right spacing and just the right frequency that when infrared hits atoms, it makes them move a little bit, makes them jiggle. And moving or jiggling atoms is heat. When we say something is hot, what we're really saying is its atoms are moving a little faster. So infrared produces heat, but it's not the same thing as heat. And you really see this with things like when you get to real heat, like a frying pan. You put a frying pan on a stove. It takes a little bit of time for the metal to get hot. You can hold the handle for quite a while the eggs are frying, before the handle gets hot, because heat means, again, the atoms are moving faster and faster. It takes a while for that to move up the frying pan into the handle, into your hand, but infrared moves at the speed of light. It's essentially instantaneous. So you feel infrared. Let's say you're gathered around a bonfire and some big guy steps in front of you. Instantly, as soon as they step in front of you, you can feel the absence of that kind of light. They block the infrared. It's no longer producing the heat on your skin, and you feel that effect right away as soon as they step in front of the fire. But it takes a while for the skin to respond to that with actual heat. Like when you have a fever, your atoms are actually moving about 3 miles an hour faster. Although nobody seems to go to the doctor and say, hey, doctor, I feel terrible. My atoms are all moving 3 miles an hour faster. And then he would never say, well, here's some aspirin. This will slow them down. But that's what's really happening.
What does infrared have to do with the fact that here in Texas, we have to crack our car windows on summer days?
Well, that actually is very relevant because glass is a funny thing. It lets infrared in. Mm-hmm. It lets visible light in. Let's put it this way. It lets visible light in. The visible light hitting the upholstery of the car and the plastics and things like that cause the atoms to move faster in the car. And those faster moving atoms, in turn, create infrared, which can't escape out the glass because glass is a funny structure that there's a resonance that is kind of a chaotic movement where visible light gets in, the infrared can't get out, so the heat builds up. That's what a greenhouse does or a hothouse. And so the car gets hotter and hotter, which is why, you should never leave a pet or any living thing in a car.
My guess.
It's a trap. It's an infrared trap. Light gets in, infrared doesn't get out.
My guest is Bob Berman. He's an astronomy writer and science editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac. His new book is called Zapped, From Infrared to X-Rays, The Curious History of Invisible Light. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Bob Berman about his new book, Zapped, From Infrared to X-Rays, The Curious History of Invisible Light. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter at KERAThink. Okay, Bob, ultraviolet light is really interesting because it causes a lot of deaths every year, but we can't really live without it either.
Yeah, it's one of those odd situations. We all know about sunburns, and about 8,000 people a year die of melanoma. Most of those are caused by severe sunburns, especially in one's youth, and that in turn is caused by ultraviolet. So obviously it can be deadly, and yet ultraviolet proves to be one of the best things that can happen to us because it generates the vitamin D in our bodies, which is one of the greatest anti-cancer agents that we have going for us in our body. So it's a two-way sword, yeah.
So what are we supposed to do with that? Like, how do we know that we're getting enough and not too much?
Well, I spoke to John Cannell a few times. Dr. Cannell is with the Vitamin D Council and a few other physicians who are really knowledgeable about all the research that's been done about vitamin D. And they end up concluding that we should all get as much sun as we can without burning. So that's the key. Stop avoiding it. You know, Cannell told me that we've been covering up now. You know, physicians have been urging for years now that we use sunscreen all the time, wear hats, stay indoors. Glass blocks ultraviolet, so it means it prevents us from developing vitamin D. Kids used to play outdoors after school. I don't know if you're old enough to remember that, but I sure do. Our parents would say, yeah, come back at dinner time.
Please leave me alone until dinner time, yeah.
Exactly. And these days, if somebody says, hey, where's your kid? And the parent says, well, I don't know, he's out playing. He'll be back in a few hours. That's almost a social service investigation offense. You know, I don't know where he's at. He's climbing. He's out there somewhere playing. He's in the playground. He's okay. But because of that, the kids are in school indoors, and then they're home, and they started being home back in the 70s and 80s thanks to the fear of crime, especially sexual predators. And then came the video game craze, and then came cell phones. And so kids are indoors all the time, and they're not getting vitamin D, and their vitamin D blood levels are really low. And these physicians are really concerned about it because they say nature never intended us to be mole people and totally avoid the sun. John Cannell, Dr. Cannell, points out that 20 minutes in strong sunlight, 20 minutes of sunbathing, and your body will produce the same amount of vitamin D that you'd get from 200 glasses of milk. So why, he says, do our bodies make so much vitamin D so quickly from the ultraviolet from the sun? Does nature ever do anything for no reason? There must be a reason why we generate so much vitamin D. And they believe that this is a cancer preventative. There have been studies that showing that people who do get more sunlight have a much lower rate of cancers. A recent study showed pancreatic cancer levels are lower for people who get adequate sunlight and vitamin D production. And so that's the idea. Don't avoid it all the time. I mean, don't get a burn. Everybody's different. So a fair-haired person with red hair or blonde hair, or blue eyes, you know, you all know who you are. You know, don't burn because that's not good for you. But don't avoid the sun either because that's not good for you either, because the vitamin, the D that we get from ultraviolet, that's the good side of ultraviolet.
Everybody has probably seen one of those scandalous TV reports or a little clip available on the internet where somebody shows, you know, a hotel room bedspread under ultraviolet light, and it is just absolutely appalling. Why can we see things under ultraviolet light that are invisible in regular light?
Yes, that's creepy. Our eyes, generally the outer layers of our eyes block at the lenses, block vitamin D, and that's good because it's protective of the retinal cells, the cone cells that otherwise would be damaged because there's a lot of energy in ultraviolet light. But That same, in fact, the same process is why people get cataracts and why it's kind of wise to wear sunglasses, especially as you get older, and stop some of that part of the spectrum, the blue part of the spectrum, even the green to the blue to the violet into the ultraviolet, and sunglasses can help block that. And that protects your eyes. So but as to why that stuff shows up, even some birds and insects, scorpions famously glow in the light of ultraviolet, and some birds can see these creatures, see their urine, because that glows in ultraviolet. And yes, health inspectors use ultraviolet detectors to see when there's stuff that we don't want to know about on motel room beds and stuff.
All right, let's jump on the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Kevin is calling from Benbrook. Hey, Kevin.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I love the show today, and two quick questions, if I may. The first one is it possible that free electrons ever exist sort of separate from atoms? And can they change their energy levels in a way that would still produce light, or do they have to be tied to an atom for that to happen?
That's a great question. No, electrons by itself can produce light. For example, in some places in space, like the famous Crab Nebula, the remnant of a supernova that blew up on the 4th of July in the year 1054, we have free electrons that are racing away. And because the strong magnetic field in the Crab Nebula makes them change direction, this changing direction produces a strange blue glow that's called synchrotron radiation. And a lot of the light that we see through a telescope coming from this nebula and some others is produced just by free electrons. So you can get that. But more commonly, the light that we see around us, like in the room right now or from the sun, those are electrons that are within atoms that are changing their position.
All right, so of course I want to talk to you about radio waves. We associate them with sound, but they are pure light.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They're just a longer form of light, a milder form, and that includes the microwave spectrum than the visible parts of the spectrum. Yeah, it's a form of light.
How did Heinrich Hertz build on the work of the scientists who came before him to discover radio waves?
Well, in theory, he knew that they should exist, and by doing experiments, especially with sparks jumping across gaps, you know, we actually see kind of his experiment accidentally. If you've ever worked with cars and seen spark plugs that are, or wires that aren't working right and are shorting out, and you hear that snap, and you happen to have your radio on at that time, you hear interference, or you can hear that snap in on the radio spectrum, and those are radio waves being generated by sparks. So he showed that it's real, but he didn't know that we'd ever use that to carry voices and signals and the stuff that we call radio today. In fact, they for a long time they called it Hertzian waves. They didn't call it radio waves. And when his students at school said, well, what's the purpose of these radio waves? He said, well, nothing, really. And visiting scientists would say, well, you discovered this, you have all this attention on you, what does it prove? He said, well, it just proves that that the others who predicted it theoretically were right. It really doesn't have any purpose. He couldn't think of any benefit for it. It took others like Marconi and initially Tesla, although Tesla gave up on it way too soon, to work with it and produce what we now use it for mostly, which is radio, like right now.
So our frequency here at KERA is 90.1 in North Texas, and it was like you wrote this book for us because that's the example you give in the book. How many KERA waves are passing us all every second in this listening area?
That's right. So if your frequency is 90.1, that means that there's 90,100 because the frequency on the dial is equal to in kilohertz. So thousands of waves. So 90 on the dial means 90,000 waves per second are going through your radio, your body, and everything else. In the FM dial, the waves are in millions of waves per second. Now, are you FM or AM?
We are an FM station.
FM, so I just said a wrong thing. Take all of that back.
Okay.
It's not
okay.
Thousands. On the FM dial, the 90 corresponds to megahertz, millions of waves per second. So 90.1 means 90 million waves per second. Boy, that's a lot. So you're on your dial, 90.1, 90 million, 100,000 waves are passing through you and me and our radios every second when tuned to the station. Even when not tuned to the station, they're still there. We're just not doing anything with them.
What did it take for anybody to harness Hertzian waves and recognize that they could carry signals that we wanted to send and receive?
Yeah, the first idea was, hey, maybe we could have Morse code without all those wires. Mm. And maybe messages could be transmitted to ships at sea where you just can't have wires. And the early people who were doing it, people like Marconi, were succeeding in longer and longer distances with more powerful transmitters and better technology. First things called coherers, and then another advance, which were vacuum tubes. And by the time the Titanic went down, ships were starting to have radio wave receivers and transmitters. And that's why those 700 people on the Titanic were saved by the Carpathia, which was something like, if I remember right, I know I wrote the book, but that was a couple of years ago. I think it was something like 70 miles away where the ship was, and got the signal by radio waves to come and help and save 700 lives.
All right, I want to go back to the phones. 800-933-5372 is our number. Anna is calling from Dallas. Hi, Anna.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Great, thank you. I was curious about the recent use of xenon light in hospitals for disinfection. It seems to be replacing traditional methods with bleach and chemicals. And I was reading about the ability to kill and disinfect surgery in operating rooms with xenon light.
Well, the xenon by itself operates because there's a gas, in this case a noble gas, in an otherwise vacuum tube. In other words, a small amount of xenon light with a high voltage passing through it, and that's what produces the light. As in all other cases, there are electrons in the xenon atom that are changing their positions. Every time they move closer to the center of the xenon atom, they give off a little bit of light, and there it is. But the question is, what kind of light? And if it's the kind of bulb that can produce ultraviolet, now you have something that can be used for sterilization in a hospital, because UV is the beginning of the ionization zone. You see, visible light can't do that. Radio waves, we were just talking about, cannot do that. But from ultraviolet and all the waves that are of ultraviolet's shortness or fineness, many more waves per second onward, and so that includes ultraviolet and x-rays and gamma rays, now you're talking about something that's bad for life, because it can cause the ionization means that atoms are losing their electrons are being stripped away. So it's bad for DNA, bad for chromosomes, bad for life. And that this can include bacteria, and this can include ourselves, which is why getting severe sunburns is bad. But yeah, ultraviolet, as we all know, if you have a hot tub and you have a UV light source or a swimming pool with that, very useful for us and increasingly in hospital settings too, yes.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is astronomy writer Bob Berman. We're talking about his new book, Zapped, From Infrared to X-Rays, The Curious History of Invisible Light. You can join us at 800-933-5372. Okay, how does light keep our GPS systems working?
Oh, that's wonderful. We all love that our GPSs, don't we? I don't know if a lot of people realize how it works, but it works by the speed of light. And essentially, we've got satellites that through microwave signals, and they're all located 11,000 miles up. They're not all the way at 22,300, which is where a satellite would not move, where it would match the rotation of Earth. At 11,000 miles up, it'll cross the sky once a day. So there's a constellation of satellites so that there's always at least three or four, and you need three to do bare bones GPS, four to do the full signal, including your elevation. And what happens is that your GPS in your car or handheld if you're going camping or something, or in your boat, receive signals from three or preferably four satellites with the time stamped on them, essentially. These are time signals. And the signals you receive always have the wrong time. Huh. And because there's a reference signal that goes along with it that tells your GPS unit what the right time is, you can see that all these signals from these four satellites are all the wrong time. Why are they wrong? Because it takes a little bit of time for the signal to reach you. Even up at 11,000 miles, that takes 17 hundredths of a second to arrive. Even traveling 186,282 miles a second, even then, the signal is delayed. So your GPS in your car asks itself the question, where do I have to be on Earth to be this particular distance from satellite A and this other distance from satellite B and this other distance from satellite C? And because of the wrong time received from each satellite, it knows how far it must be from each satellite, performs a triangulation, and pinpoints to within a few feet where you are. And because it last did another calculation just maybe a second ago or a few seconds ago, it knows how you moved since then, so it knows your speed and direction and how long it'll take you to get to Dallas from wherever you are. And so it's a wonderful system, but it wouldn't work if light were infinitely fast. It wouldn't work if light were too slow. And it almost doesn't work now because there are all sorts of Einsteinian things that throw off the speed of light. For example, if your gravity is stronger, your time will travel slower. If your speed is faster, your time will travel slower. Well, here we are on the surface of the Earth where the gravity is stronger than it is where the satellites are. So that throws things off. The satellites are moving fast. That would throw things off. You're on a part of Earth where the Earth is spinning. The spin is zero at the poles, but at the equator, you'd be moving at 1,038 miles an hour. That has to be figured in. Hmm. And there are six different effects like that that always have to be compensated for. Otherwise, the darn GPS wouldn't work at all.
My guest is Bob Berman. He's science editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac and an astronomy writer in general. His new book is called Zapped, From Infrared to X-Rays, The Curious History of Invisible Light. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is astronomy writer Bob Berman, whose new book is called Zapped, From Infrared to X-Rays, The Curious History of Invisible Light. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter at @KERAThink. Bob, sometimes I think the number one benefit of learning about science is that we have less to fear from things that sometimes are held out and made to scare us. A term like exposed to radiation becomes far less frightening if you have some context.
Oh, yeah, I think so. And radiation is one of those catchwords. Everybody's afraid of it these days.
So when we talk about radiation, is that all the light that touches us is radiation?
Yeah, there's really two definitions. One, the more general one, is any kind of light is electromagnetic radiation. So even the light from a firefly or a cozy red sunset, obviously harmless, in fact beneficial to us, are termed electromagnetic radiation, and they can't hurt us. Then there's a separate word for it when we say, watch out, don't get too much radiation. And that term popularly means ionizing light and other things that can strip electrons from atoms, damage genes and chromosomes, give way to cancer, and that's harmful. So generally, first you have to decide which way you're going to use the word radiation, and then you can talk about it.
So eating a banana exposes us to as much radiation as living across the street from a nuclear power plant that is up to code?
Yeah, absolutely. You get more radiation from eating one banana thanks to the radioactive potassium in a banana. A little bit of the potassium in the banana is radioactive, not enough to hurt you, but we all have some internal radiation because of that, whereas a nuclear power plant, even if you lived there for a year, you'd get less radiation than eating one banana. Yeah. So you always have to specify how much. In a scare story, somebody can say, it's giving off radiation, you know, close the plant. But
right.
Then a smart person would have to say, well, how much radiation? And that's, everything's in the details. For example, the higher you go, the more radiation you get, very much detectably so that people up at Denver are getting quite a bit more radiation than those of us closer to sea level, as you and I are. But is it really troublesome? Or going in a plane, that's kind of a biggie. One trip, coast-to-coast trip from the East Coast to California and back gives you definitely a detectable amount of radiation. Enough radiation so that lifelong career flight attendants and professional pilots actually have a 1% higher cancer rate than the rest of the population because of this high altitude radiation that they're receiving. So then it starts to be significant. So there has to be a cutoff. What's not worth being afraid about, and where do you start to take action?
Why has the environmental damage from the Chernobyl disaster been so much more severe than the meltdown at the Fukushima plant in Japan?
Well, Chernobyl was a really special case. It was the kind of plant built on the cheap that we'd never do in Europe or the United States. It didn't even have a containment building, so there was no way to keep the radiation inside of it. And then the people who were running it did an unauthorized experiment, shutting down the safeties and saying, well, what happens if we shut down all the safety controls and then let this happen? So they really made it happen. They made this very serious accident occur that would not have occurred in a Western plant, or if you had just been following the normal protocols, or if you had a building with a normal, you know, the containment, then you would. Even Fukushima was a sort of special case because they put all their marbles into it, that if an emergency happened, they'd have a backup diesel generator to at least provide the cooling for the nuclear materials. But they located it on the ground floor where it could and did get washed away by the incoming tsunami. So here you had the one of the largest earthquakes in Earth's history, producing one of the largest tsunamis ever recorded. And everything was dependent on first walls to keep out the water and then backup systems that were crazily put on the first floor, the ground floor, instead of up on the roof. And none of that would have happened if the backup systems had been on the roof. So it was a very special and unusual and unfortunate case. And even then, if you look at what the reports are, the UN and other reports about how much damage was done from Fukushima, the radiation there, the UN report says the future expected number of deaths from that so-called disaster will be zero. But a U.S. university came to the conclusion that there might be 100 deaths ultimately from cancer from that. And so that wasn't, you know, when you compare that to things that could happen and how much power is being generated, that's still not the end of the world. So we tend to exaggerate nuclear power plants, such as Three Mile Island in the United States, which is the worst ever disaster we have. And if you look up in any book about Three Mile Island, it'll say it was a disaster, and yet nobody was injured, no property, no private property was harmed, and the number of deaths altogether, even going into the future, is expected to be zero, including injuries. So if no one's injured, and there's no private property damaged, in what sense is it a disaster or a catastrophe? So we need a little bit of, you know, equilibrium here to compare apples with apples when we're talking about radiation disasters. On the other hand, too much radiation is bad for you, as you know from the book.
Okay, so years ago I worked at a TV station in a small market, and before we got satellite trucks, I'm dating myself here, we had a little unit that you'd set up on a tripod, and it would send a microwave signal to a tower mounted in the highest place in town. I'm sure that people stepped in front of that live microwave signal more than once, and yet we never had a photographer cooked. So how did they stay safe?
Well, it's true. And microwaves are a big can of worms because there's a lot of people who are afraid of them. I live in the mountains in upstate New York, not too far from the famous Woodstock, New York. And a lot of people here are afraid of microwaves and cell phones and think that they're very dangerous. But on the other hand, the studies that have been done mostly show that it's okay. Now, it's the last word isn't in about microwaves, but when you first look at it, they should not be harmful because they're part of the radio spectrum, which is a gentler light than even visible light. In other words, nobody would be afraid of red mood lighting or being in moonlight, and microwaves are gentler than moonlight. On the other hand, they can't ionize things, they can't strip electrons, they can't cause mutations or cell changes or harm DNA. So on paper, they should not be able to cause cancer. They should not give us a problem. And indeed, many of the studies that have been done, like the million-person study in Europe and many others, have shown safety, shown no bad results. On the other hand, the UN a few years ago decided that to label it as a class 2B carcinogen. Class 2B means it's possibly a carcinogen, not probably and certainly not definitely. So what's the real truth? Well, there's ongoing studies. What it does do, microwaves can heat up tissue. We know that because we have microwave ovens, and you can see it, you know, cooking a hot dog in a few seconds. If it can do that to that, what might it do to you? Well, workers who are much closer to them, and technicians and people who service microwave towers and get a lot higher doses, don't have a higher rate of cancer. But nonetheless, how do we know it's really safe? So there's ongoing studies, and some of them should have their results in just the next year or two. So we'll know a lot more until then. And if you're worried about microwaves from cell phones, just use the headphone feature. Don't hold it up against your head, because like all forms of invisible light and visible light, it falls off inversely with the square of distance, meaning that if you hold a cell phone against your head, and let's say it's 1 inch from your brain, if you instead put it in a pocket and it's 1 foot from your brain, you're now 12 times farther away. So you multiply 12 times 12, that's 144, and that means the microwaves hitting your brain will be 144 times weaker. If it's in your pocket than if it's held up against your brain. So you might want to use a headphone or do texting instead. And there's all sorts of things you can do. Plus, cell phones are now using much less of a strong signal than they were just a few years ago. So even that's changing. And everything's changing so much that you can't give a last word on microwave danger. I personally think that at worst, it's going to prove to be a very small hazard, maybe one death per 40 million users. That's the way it looks like it's heading. But again, you could take precautions if you're concerned, especially by using headsets and stuff like that.
You're listening.
We'll know a lot more in the next 2 or 3 years.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Let's go back to the phones now. We have Ivan calling from Irving. Hi, Ivan.
Hey.
Hi. Go right ahead.
Okay. My question is about solar panels. How dangerous are they if they're broken or in any kind of form? And how much should I invest in solar panels if I put them on the roof of my house?
What do you know about solar panels, Bob?
Well, I have solar panels. I love them. Not on my house. I have them on my property, and I look at them from my window, and my wife hates them and made us put up trees and bushes just to hide them so we can't look at them. And to me, they look great. I just love looking at them. and like the idea of helping the planet and supplying, does supply most of my electricity. So I like them. What do I know about it technically? Nothing. It's totally outside of my field. What happens if they break? I have no idea. So I can't really answer this caller's questions except to say I think they're cool, but that's not really a scientific or an expert type answer, is it?
Tell us about these gamma ray bubbles discovered at the center of the Milky Way. Stars don't emit gamma rays, so like, can anybody speculate what these things are and where they came from?
No, this is the weirdest, greatest mystery that I've seen in decades in astronomy. And it was discovered by a gamma ray telescope. Gamma rays are the most energetic parts of the electromagnetic spectrum. They're the type of light that's the most violent. The waves are closest together. They have the most energy. And so the Fermi Gamma Ray Orbiting Observatory a few years ago, looking toward the center of our galaxy, detected something that nobody can explain. There are these two giant bubbles made just of gamma rays. One bubble is centered just north of the Milky Way's plane. Now imagine seeing our galaxy sideways. It would look like a pancake that you were seeing from the side. Mm-hmm. When do we ever get to see a pancake from the side? Never, because, you know, it's on the plate. We're always looking down at the top of the pancake. So you'd have to hold it in your hand to see it from the side, and then it would kind of flop over, plus it would burn your hand. I don't know if we ever see a pancake from the side. But, okay, picture it. If you picture it from the side, that's our galaxy shape. You know, it's thin, and it's the bubbles are each above that plane, and one is below the plane, and they meet, or are tangent, at the very center of the galaxy. So it's like two bubbles, one on top of another, touching each other to form kind of the number eight shape, or an hourglass shape. And where the two bubbles just touch each other, that's the center of the galaxy. So the bubbles don't surround the center, they just each touch each other at the center. They actually surround a spot above and below the center of the galaxy. And what this means is they're so big that when you look towards the south tonight or any night, they fill up half of the southern sky.
Wow.
They take up the whole sky halfway to straight up. So they're absolutely enormous. They're giving off the same energy as 100,000 exploding stars. 100,000 supernovae is being radiated from it. So a tremendous amount of energy. And they're coming from a space of nothingness, because those spots above and below the galaxy, there's nothing there. So why do you have gamma rays radiating from these empty places? Why do each of the bubbles touch each other at the center of the galaxy? There is a black hole at the center of our galaxy, weighing the same as about 4 million suns, but it's sleepy. It hasn't been active. It's got no stars to eat. It's got no food to eat, and hasn't been active for as long as we've been observing. But even if it was active, that would mean that the bubble should radiate from there, from where the black hole is, instead of the edge of the bubble being there touching the other bubble. So nothing makes sense. Nobody can figure it out. And when we say Fermi bubbles or gamma ray bubbles, let's just say we got a mystery.
Bob Berman is an astronomy writer and science editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac. His new book is called Zapped, From Infrared to X-Rays, The Curious History of Invisible Light. Bob, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for spending time with us.
Oh, the pleasure was mine. Thanks so much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. And Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.